All right, it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, the 5th of February, 2015. Wanted to make sure that you had a pencil and paper handy because I'm going to be reading emails, web pages, addresses, times, dates, things you might want to remember later. So you might want to just have some way to get the whole thing recorded so you can act on it. The Buffalo Field Campaign, for instance, is having their week of action next week, February 9th through the 16th. It's an urgent call out for motivated volunteers to come and stand strong beside the bison in Yellowstone National Park before the government slaughters 800 to 900 of the wild bison from these precious herds. While the hunts have been taking the lives of bison since November, the National Park Service and the Department of Livestock have begun to capture bison to ship them off to slaughter. Here at the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters just outside West Yellowstone, we have been feeling the urgency to build a greater force of resistance to the dreaded Stevens Creek Trap. This facility is a space where wild bison are corralled, injured, and tortured through squeeze chutes with cattle prods, all this tearing their families apart. Throughout the week of action, you will be trained by experienced Buffalo Field Campaign coordinators and volunteers on the history of the issue, guerrilla media, animal tracking, and being on the front lines with the bison, and it will all culminate in an action to confront the slaughter of wild bison. If you're interested in joining our week of action, please visit our webpage to check it out to volunteer. We ask you specify in the email that you will be sending us that you are interested in coming for the week of action. The Buffalo Field Campaign has been advocating for wild bison since 1997. As a strong grassroots organization with years of direct action resistance, activists all over the world have stood beside the bison in their struggle. Once again, it's next week, February 9th through the 16th. Get your butt to Montana. More information at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And the 2015 Earth First Round River Winter Rendezvous is coming. Greetings from colonially occupied Chumash Territory in what is known as Santa Barbara, California. Here in the serene setting of coastal sage scrub and mountainous chaparral, we will be hosting the 2015 Earth First Winter Rendezvous. Invite you to join us on the evening of February 20th and stay till the 23rd for a weekend of workshops and training, strategy, and fun. If you can have fun without beer, I guess. As I write this invitation, the Western Scrub Jays debate each other over their foraged breakfast of seeds and insects. The acorn woodpecker drums diligently against the oak, and the exuberant call of one I have yet to identify echoes through the canyon. And just south of us, 19 wells are set to be fracked in the close border to the Sespe Endangered Condor Sanctuary and the Hopper Mountain National Wildlife Refuge. All this stuff is happening in Santa Barbara. The Winter Rendezvous will consist of workshops, Earth First History, Strategic Direct Action, Tactics, Santa Barbara Fossil Fuel Infrastructure, Threats to the Sespe Creek Condor Sanctuary, Decolonization and Collective Liberation, Know Your Rights, Navigating Conflict in Your Community, and Genetically Engineered Trees, a New Threat. And more. Contact us if you're interested in hosting a workshop. But there are some things you should know before coming to the Winter Rendezvous. Come ready to camp. Bring as much of your own water as possible. No dogs or pets except service animals. No drugs or alcohol will be allowed at the event. Come with the intention to learn, organize, and build. Be respectful to the land and those around you. Breakfast and dinner will be provided. Bring your own dishware. A sliding scale suggested donation of $20 to $40. However, no one will be turned away for lack of funds, and directions will be posted at the website a few days before the start. The website is www.efoc2015.wordpress.com. That's efoc2015.wordpress.com. If you want to send an email, send it to efoc2015@riseup.net. That's Earth First Organizing Conference 2015 at riseup.net. Once again, the date's February 20th through the 23rd near Santa Barbara, California. And coming up in March, the Mountain Justice Spring Break, fifth year in a row. The Renew Collective and SAMS will be hosting Mountain Justice Spring Break in Virginia from March 7th through the 14th, somewhere in Southwest Virginia. They'll have a whole lot of stuff. You'll learn about mountaintop removal, chance to meet, greet, and do a little work out in the field. Basically, it'll be a great time. Hopefully, they'll tell us where it exactly is sometime before March 7th. And moving to Oregon, activists barricade a logging road in Elliott State Forest in this communique received anonymously over the Earth First Newswire. A road accessing 11 Creek No. 3, a 41-acre timber sale auctioned to Scott Timber Company in December of 2014, has been blocked by a slash pile in protest of continued clear-cutting in Oregon's Elliott State Forest. The timber sale lies near a marbled murrelet management area, a state-designated habitat zone for threatened seabirds that nest exclusively in mature forest. While much of 11 Creek No. 3 is too young to provide nesting habitat for the marbled murrelet, it contains a healthy mix of 40 to 60-year-old hardwoods and conifers. If left unlogged, the sale would become a kind of ancient forest that the murrelet and other species need to survive. If logged, it will join the acres of barren slopes, washed-out cliffs, and dense dug fir plantations that have replaced Oregon's ancient forests. Roughly half of the Elliott State Forest contains never-before-logged coastal rainforest. Activists acknowledge that the younger second and third growth stands that comprise the Elliott's other half may benefit from restorative thinning and other types of conservation management, but clear cuts, like the one planned for 11 Creek No. 3, destroy the forest's potential to recover from decades of harsh logging. More than 95% of Oregon's oldest forests have been logged. Now areas logged in the 1950s and 60s are just barely regaining the complex ecosystems and mature structure necessary to become vibrant biodiverse forests like those of the past, and big timber is flattening them. To the Oregon Department of Forestry, you are sacrificing the Elliott for corporate pennies, and you are making a mockery of your mission to sustainably steward state land. Stop now. To the Scott Timber Company, when you privatized parts of this public forest last spring, you stole from everyone who hikes, hunts, fishes, camps, and otherwise enjoys the woods at Adam Ridge Tract 1 and Benson Ridge Parcels. You're not going to get away with that, and you're not going to get away with cutting 11 Creek No. 3. Stay out of the Elliott. Not another clear cut. Explore restorative thinning and conservation management options for the Elliott State Forest instead. And up in Northern California, Caltrans has been caught trying to fool the public again. Caltrans gave in to pressure from Environmental Protection Information Center and extended the public comment period for the Four Bridges project. Caltrans' initial release of the project proposal violated the California Environmental Quality Act, as it failed to adequately provide the public with access to various environmental studies, which the agency relied on to justify its conclusion that the project would have no significant impact and that further study wasn't needed. For the last few weeks, Environmental Protection Information Center has diligently pursued Caltrans in an effort to hold Caltrans accountable to the law. The heart of the CEQA is about public review and transparency. The CEQA process serves the very important function of enabling the public to make an independent, reasoned judgment about the proposed project. Without access to the environmental documents, the public cannot participate in a meaningful way. Caltrans announced the comment period to the public on New Year's Eve in a classified section of an obscure newspaper with a 30-day study period on the project. Many of the documents necessary to fully analyze the impacts of the project were not made available to the public. EPIC insisted that Caltrans release the documents and sent out an action alert to which hundreds of supporters responded and requested Caltrans release the documents for public review. The comment deadline was scheduled to close last week. However, at the 11th hour, Caltrans extended the public comment period and released various technical documents on its website. The new public comment period closes on February 23rd at 5 p.m. If you have not already taken action, please go to the following website, www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. and a federal fish agency opposes the Shasta Dam raise. And this news story from Intercontinental Cry. The Minimum Wintu tribe, fishing groups, and environmentalists have been fighting a federal plan to raise Shasta Dam for many years, since the 18.5-foot proposed dam raising would flood many of the tribe's remaining sacred areas and further imperil salmon and steelhead populations on the Sacramento River. Any raising of the dam, even a few feet, will flood some of our last remaining sacred sites on the McLeod River, sites we still use today, said Colleen Sisk, Winnemem chief and spiritual leader. We can't be Winnemem any place else but the McLeod River. And they've already lost their village, which was at the junction of the McLeod and the Sacramento River. It's under hundreds of feet of water, or at least it was when the dam was full. We pray that the Spirit brings us, beings hear us, and bring all of our helpers from the high mountain meadows all the way to the ocean, she stated before the war dance began. Our concern is the health of the waterways. We are here at the dam that blocks the salmon on a river that should be full of salmon. The dam raising is a form of cultural genocide. The campaign by the tribe and their allies to stop Shasta Dam from being raised received a boost when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently issued a revised draft report on the proposed enlargement of the dam, revealing how the dam raise will indeed harm salmon populations. The report, obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request, concluded that it cannot support any of the proposed action alternatives, including the preferred alternative presented by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that controls and operates the dam. The Bureau of Reclamation issued a controversial draft environmental impact statement on the dam enlargement in 2013. The project must be approved by Congress and justified by both economic and environmental rationales, according to a joint news release from the California Water Impact Network and the California Sport Fishing Protection Alliance. Taxpayers would pay for two-thirds of the $1.1 billion project. In an earlier cost-benefit analysis, Bureau of Reclamation determined that payments by the Central Valley Project water and power customers alone would provide minimal justification for the project economically. Consequently, 61% of the economic justification now touted by the agency is a larger cold water pool behind the dam to improve Sacramento River salmon survival during critically dry years, the group said. In response, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stated in its recent draft report that the project is not justifiable because it provides no net benefits to salmon and will result in negative environmental impacts that cannot be mitigated. The limited benefit derived from dam enlargement and the preferred alternative CP4A during dry and critically dry years will likely be offset by river conditions downstream of the Red Bluff pumping plant in the main stem, Sacramento, and the Delta, the report stated. The enlargement of Shasta Dam and water management scenario described for CP4A will reduce the rearing capacity of the Sacramento River for juvenile salmonids by further altering the natural successional process of riparian forest habitat and by reducing juvenile salmonid access to the high-quality rearing habitat found in floodplains and bypasses because of reduced high water flow events. Tom Stokely, the water policy analyst for the California Water Impact Network, commented, "This report documents the Bureau of Reclamation's own data that shows the project will not benefit salmon in the Sacramento River. We knew all along the Bureau of Reclamation had a phony economic justification to enlarge Shasta Dam, and now we have another federal agency agreeing with us." The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service report further stated that the Bureau of Reclamation would have considered several options that were removed early in the consideration process if salmon restoration had been a true priority. Those actions include repairing the multi-million dollar Shasta Dam temperature control device, restoring the riparian corridor along the Sacramento River, operational changes to Shasta Dam to increase cold water storage and increase minimum flows, increasing water use efficiency in local canals, and considering conjunctive use of other existing and planned water storage facilities in the Central Valley. For more information, go to www.intercontinentalcry.org. That's intercontinentalcry.org. And a rare Sierra Nevada fox has been seen in Yosemite National Park in this story from the Environment News Service. Photos of the rare Sierra Nevada red fox, Vulpes vulpes nicator, have been taken by motion-triggered cameras in Yosemite National Park, the first confirmed sighting of this species of fox in the park in nearly 100 years. The Sierra Nevada red fox of California is one of the rarest mammals in North America, with fewer than 50 individuals surviving in the wild. Yosemite Park wildlife biologist had gone on a 5-day backcountry trip in the farther northern part of the park to check on previously deployed motion-sensitive cameras. They found images of the fox taken on two separate instances, December 13th and January 4th. We are thrilled to hear about the sighting of the Sierra Nevada red fox, one of the most rare and elusive animals in the Sierra Nevada, said Yosemite National Park Superintendent Don Neubacher. National parks like Yosemite provide habitat for all wildlife, and it is encouraging to see that the red fox is sighted in the park, he said. Confirmation of the Sierra Nevada red fox in Yosemite National Park's vast alpine wilderness provides an opportunity to join research partners in helping to protect this imperiled animal, said Sarah Stock, wildlife biologist in Yosemite. We're excited to work across our boundary to join efforts with other researchers that will ultimately give these foxes the best chance for recovery. The nearest verified sightings of the Sierra Nevada red foxes have been in the Sonora Pass area just north of the park, where biologists from the University of California, Davis, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the U.S. Forest Service had been monitoring a small Sierra Nevada red fox population, first documented by the Forest Service in 2010. Before 2010, the last verified sighting of a Sierra Nevada red fox in the region was 20 years ago. Hoping to document more of the rare animals, the Yosemite Carnivore crew will continue to survey the Sierra Nevada red fox using remote cameras. At each camera station, the crew also set up some hair snare stations to obtain hair samples for genetic analysis. Through genetic analysis, the park can learn more about the diversity within the population and to confirm whether the fox or foxes detected in Yosemite are genetically related to those from the Sonora Pass area. The Sierra Nevada red fox detections are part of a larger study funded by the Yosemite Conservancy to determine occurrence and distribution of rare carnivores in Yosemite National Park. Thank you to all our colleagues who have been helping us with this project in many important ways, said Neubacher. Naming the Central Sierra Environmental Resource Center, the U.S. Department of Interior's Bureau of Land Management, and Yosemite Backcountry Rangers and Volunteers, in addition to scientists from the University of California, Davis, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the U.S. Forest Service. First protected in 1864, the 1,200 square miles of Yosemite National Park encompass a vast wilderness area of waterfalls, deep valleys, expansive meadows, ancient giant sequoia trees, and a big puddle of water that San Francisco uses for its drinking. Yosemite National Park supports more than 400 species of vertebrates, including fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. Wildlife species in the park include bobcat, gray fox, red fox, mountain king snake, Gilbert skink, white-headed woodpecker, brown creeper, spotted owl, and a wide variety of bat species. Above the tree line, species such as pika, yellow-bellied marmot, white-tailed hare, Clark's nutcracker, and rosy finch are found. Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep live in the Yosemite area only around Tioga Pass, where a small reintroduced population exists. And death by chocolate is a problem for bears in New Hampshire, in this story by Richard Valmanis, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. New Hampshire wildlife officials are drawing up a proposal to curb the use of chocolate as bait by hunters seeking to draw black bears out of the woods after four of the wild animals were found dead at a trapping site from an overdose of chocolate. Bears find sweets irresistible during the autumn hunting season and eat voraciously to build up fat stores for winter hibernation, said Kent Gustafson, the wildlife program supervisor for the state's Fish and Game Department. Given the circumstances, we certainly don't want to see something like this happen again, Gustafson said. I expect we will have a proposal to deal with this sometime next month. Four black bears, including two cubs, were found dead in September, within 50 feet of where a hunter had placed nearly 100 pounds of chocolate and donuts as bait, wildlife officials said. An autopsy conducted by the University of New Hampshire showed the bears died of an overdose of theobromine, a naturally occurring toxic ingredient in chocolate, and it's related to caffeine, but deadly to many carnivores. Gustafson said the deaths were the first of their kind reported in New Hampshire, but followed similar incidents with black bears and raccoons in Michigan. He said the proposal put forward by the department could range from banning any chocolate in bear bait to allowing it only in limited quantities like in donuts or chocolate sprinkles on other sweets. Hunters killed 784 bears in New Hampshire during the 2014 hunting season, the vast majority using bait and most of the rest using hounds to track down the animals. New Hampshire has about 4,800 black bears, officials estimated. Endangered red wolf is threatened by North Carolina hunting laws in this story by Tamara of Piedmont Earth First, as found in the Earth First Newswire. In North Carolina, the hunting of one predator species may wipe out the last population of red wolves, Canis rufus, in the world. While this species of red wolf may not be genetically pure to some critics, they carry many genes of the original red wolf inhabitants that were virtually wiped out through targeted hunting by European colonizers. In an effort to complete the extinction of the red wolf, hunters are fighting to take back their manifest destiny right to kill coyotes, a species that has naturally expanded its range from the western to eastern United States. The coyote is nearly indistinguishable from the small, reintroduced, endangered eastern red wolf, many of whom are being mistakenly shot and killed even while wearing their radio collars. Unfortunately, coyotes are threatened not only by hunters who fear predators, but also by the actions of conservationists who view them as dirtying the genetic purity of wolf species. Some nature enthusiasts even use invasion biology terminology such as foreigner to appeal to readers' xenophobia. Coyotes that have established in eastern states have been found to sometimes breed with wolves, creating a naturally occurring hybrid species some call coyote wolves. These animals are filling a niche left open by the destruction of wolf populations, now preying on larger species such as deer. They could possibly restore some of the ecosystem balance that has harmed by the removal of the top predator species, wolves. What is missed by some wolf conservationists is that coyotes are migrating on their own as they search for food and habitat, and the interbreeding of these animals could increase genetic variability and make them more resilient to degraded environments. One study from the United Kingdom states, "We conclude that hybridization can increase evolutionary responsiveness, and that taxa able to exchange genes with distant relatives may better survive rapid environmental change. Climate change and habit loss, anyone? We need to oppose both the cultural fear of predators promoted by livestock and hunting interests and the flawed logic of genetic purity pushed by some conservationists if we want healthy ecosystems that include top predators such as coyotes and wolves. In the Southeast, the Wildlife Resources Commission has pursued expanding coyote hunting even in areas where it puts endangered red wolves at risk. It's important for those who care about the red wolves to speak up against daytime hunting in Dare, Terrell, Hyde, Beaufort, and Washington counties. North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission will hold public hearings in February to receive comments on permanent rules regarding conditional coyote hunting in the five-county red wolf reintroduction area in northeastern North Carolina and the designation of the red wolf as a state-listed threatened species. The first public hearing has already taken place. However, the next public hearing will be at 7 p.m. on February 17th at the Wildlife Commission Headquarters Auditorium, 1751 Varsity Drive in Raleigh, North Carolina. Once again, that's February 17th at 7 p.m. at the Wildlife Commission Headquarters Auditorium, 1751 Varsity Drive, Raleigh, North Carolina. Comments can also be made online to the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission or sent by letter to North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, 1701 Mail Service Center, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27699-1701. That address again, North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, 1701 Mail Service Center, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27699-1701. Comments will be accepted through the 16th of March, 2015. And South Africa moves 100 rhinos outside of the country to fight poaching in this story by Ed Stoddard with editing by James Macaria, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. South Africa said recently that it had moved around 100 rhinos to unspecified neighboring states as part of efforts to stem the illicit slaughter of the animals for their horns. Home to around 80% of the global rhino population, South Africa is at the epicenter of a poaching crisis. Government figures released show the country lost a record 1,215 rhinos last year, about a 20% increase of the 2013 toll, and 49 have been slain so far this year. The animals are being poached to meet soaring demand for rhino horn, coveted as an ingredient in traditional medicine in fast-growing economies such as China and Vietnam. South Africa said in August that it planned to relocate rhinos from poaching hotspots in the famed Kruger National Park, where about two-thirds of the killings take place. Environmental Affairs Minister Edna Molewa told a news briefing for security reasons the precise countries where the rhinos have been moved will not be named. Conservationists say that Botswana is a likely candidate as it has vast, sparsely populated areas and has had little poaching. Mozambique, one of the world's poorest countries where many of the poachers hail from, would almost certainly not be on the list. Malewa said that 56 of the animals had been moved within the Kruger itself, which is the size of Israel, from danger zones to an intensive protection zone. In 2015, another 200 rhinos will be moved from Kruger to what Malewa said were strongholds where the animals will be safer from poaching. Kruger's rhino population is around 9,000. 20 bids have been received to purchase the animals and are being evaluated. The money raised will be put back into conservation projects. Private ranchers own around 5,000 of South Africa's roughly 20,000 rhinos, part of a thriving game farming industry in Africa's most advanced economy, catering to ecotourism and hunting. The ministry revealed on that South Africa's stockpile of rhino horn, government and private, collected over the decades from animals that died naturally or from legal hunts, was around 25 tons. Rhino horn, the sale of which is strictly prohibited, is estimated by conservationists to be worth around $65,000 a kilogram, which is more than gold or platinum. So the 25 tons would fetch an estimated of $1.6 billion. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon here on Free Radio at 3 p.m. Or next Monday at 9:30 in the evening, you can tune in to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow, Idaho. Or Radio Free Edmonton, YEG Radio at WordPress.com, 2 p.m. on Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays. Or you could go to RadioForAll.net and listen online or download this edition of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.